Within Judaism, there is an affirmation of belief made by adherents that has been recognized as remarkable and unique among the world's religions. This statement was very unusual at the time that it was made. It was a radical idea. It redefined, in writing, man's relationship with any deity, whether a legitimate deity being God or all of the false deities that one could examine. There we go. That affirmation is called the Shema. The Shema is a series of about 20 verses collected from both Deuteronomy and the book of Numbers as well. And it's an attempt to really just kind of solidify and, in a concise statement, talk about the commitment of the Jew to God within Judaism. In this message, we're going to explore one verse from the Shema. And it's one you know well. It's in Deuteronomy 6. Because this single verse, it is arguably one of the greatest keys to properly worshiping God. And I think that's something that we all take time to consider. How do we worship God? What's the right way to worship God? How do we interact with God in a way that does honor to Him and what He has offered us? So please turn to Deuteronomy 6. So before chapter 6 here, Moses reminds the people of all the years of wandering in the desert and all the things that happened to them while they were doing so. He reminds them of the miracles, not all of them because there were so many, but many of the most important ones of that God performed on their behalf. And then he recites the Ten Commandments. So with that as the backdrop, he now comes into the beginning of what is called the Shema. Let's start in verse 4. Again, these are verses you're familiar with. We've covered them many times before. I'm hoping to add something just a little different in this message. Verse 4, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one." Now, in comparison to pagan religions, this was radical thinking. It declares that the Lord that has been revealed to them since they left Egypt is their God. They don't have a whole pantheon of gods like they do in Egypt to choose from. Well, maybe I want the god of agriculture or the god of strength, or maybe I want to have children, so I'm going to switch over to this god for a couple of years, and maybe that will work for me. No, Israel has just one God, and they belong to Him. If they thought that verse was radical, the next verse is even more so, and it's demand for action. Verse 6, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength." It's a commandment. I said this verse is arguably one of the greatest keys in properly worshiping God. In reality, it's really the first seven words that I focus on here. You shall love the Lord your God. That by itself is a radical difference from what mankind had in the past. Let's explore why. I'd like you to consider how bold the instruction is, just to start off. It is very bold. It demands complete devotion. The seat of desire is represented by the heart. The mind and its intellect as well are called on. And finally, the full commitment of the body in every way. There are very few vocations in life that demand such utter commitment. The Sansino commentary, talking about this section of the Bible, observes that this is the first instance in all human history that love of God was demanded in any religion. It's the first time. It was unheard of. Rituals, offering, worship, prayers, and the like, yeah, absolutely common within pagan worship as well. But love? No, that wasn't expected, much less demanded. Now, there was a goddess of love in Greek and in certainly Egypt mythology as well, But even there, as I was doing research, it wasn't a demand that you love that God, goddess in that case. But with the God of Israel, which is our God as well, love is demanded, and rightly so. What does it look like when we love something? Whether it's a romantic love, a platonic love, a family-focused love, love is directed outward toward others. We know this. Much of the material here we've heard many times before, but I have a twist here that I'm coming up to. It's not focused on ourselves as individuals. And the same is true for the love we are to be developing for God. But it's a mature love. It takes time to develop. It's not that instant love, two eyes meeting across the room, and it's like love at first. No, it's a mature love. It's one that grows. And the love that we grow into is a response to the love that God has already shown us. He started it. And that process looks different for all of us. Now, as a teenager from a home that was very broken by divorce and abuse and abandonment and all kinds of other issues, which I've hinted at previously, so I don't think that's a surprise to anyone here, coming into the church was quite a challenge. Love? No, didn't really do anything for me. Expectations? Hey, I'm all about expectations. Tell me what you want. I'll get it done. Love, that was harder to understand. It was harder to grasp. Hearing people talk about God's love didn't exactly bring comfort. It didn't bring any resolution to the problems and the pain. I saw God's love simply as a function of God's overall desire for his own family. And that made sense. It was only over time when I could look back after I started following this way of life that I could see the impact of the changes in me and how I was different and be able to compare the differences to the rest of my family and see what God had done in my life. And that's when love started to make sense to me. 1 John 4, that epistle goes into a great deal of detail. I'm not going to quote very much of it. It goes into a lot of detail making this very point about God's love and how he extended love to us first. And in verse 19 of 1 John 4, it says this. It's a summary of everything before it. It says, "We love him because he first loved us." So I ask, do we love God? Are we fulfilling the commandment to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength? It is the greatest commandment, right? We read it in Deuteronomy 6. Jesus Christ later affirms it is the greatest commandment. But it's not just a warm feeling of comfort. And it's actually a love that is demonstrated by action. And just as God demonstrates his love toward us, he does expect that we will demonstrate our love toward him eventually. Please turn to 1 Corinthians 13. We'll take a deeper dive into examining our love for God. I was looking at it. I started in the Gospels where Jesus Christ was approached by the Pharisee lawyer. And he gave that as the example. And I was like, what does this look like, this love the Lord your God? And it dawned on me, Paul wrote several very well-known passages and statements about love. And I've always considered these statements and how I should interact with others and how I should treat others and then behave with others. But I had never applied it to my relationship with God. And I started looking at it, and I found it interesting. So, 1 Corinthians 13, I'm going to read verses 4 through 8, and then we're going to break it down. So, verse 4, love suffers long, it's patient, and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself. It's not puffed up. It does not behave rudely. It does not seek its own, and it's not provoked. Now remember, I'm looking at this from the perspective of our love toward God. It's a little different. At least it was for me. It thinks no evil. It does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. All right, so that's the full section. We're going to do a deep dive on about three of these. And then others, I'll leave to you to study on your own. And think about it from the perspective of how this applies to your love for God. Let's start with verse 4. Love suffers long. It's patient. Do we show patience toward God? When I read that, and that was the first question that came to my mind, I was like, oh, I think I'm onto something here. Do we show patience towards God? Yes, I think most of the time that we do. After all, number one, what choice do we have? But when we are forced to wait on His will, we do learn patience. And in time, we come to trust that if we have a problem that is ongoing, if we have a trial that's taking years to to overcome or address, that eventually it will get there. You know, there's the classic anecdote of the person who says, God, I want patience and I want it now. Well, that doesn't last very long, does it? In Psalm 27, David speaks of times of trial. We're going to come back to 1 Corinthians 13. But in Psalm 27, David speaks of times of trial. And this one kind of jumped out at me as really resonating well with love is patient. But he was talking about a time when it seemed like those who were attacking him might overcome him. So in Psalm 27, verse 11, it says, teach me your way, O Lord, and lead me in a smooth path because of my enemies. That's really kind of where it starts. I don't know God's way. He's got to teach us. So we start with that as an admission. And yes, we do want a smooth path because there are plenty of people who will attack us and want to distract us and pull us away from God and God's way. I know you've had those encounters. I've had them as well. He says, do not deliver me to the will of my adversaries, for false witnesses have risen against me, as such as breathe out violence. Have you ever been slandered where somebody was saying something that was very easy to disprove, that it was completely false? I just went through this again in the last month. It's just amazing. How do you put up with, or how do you address slander? I was very careful this time. I felt like it had to be addressed, but addressed in a peaceful way. And it was a learning experience for me. It truly was. Responding in a peaceful manner to slander can seem impossible. But love is patient. And love is kind. Verse 13, David says, I would have lost heart unless I had believed. Believed what? That he would see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. He has a vision of the future, the kingdom of God established on the earth, and a future salvation. All of this helped him to stand fast in the midst of being attacked unjustly. David then gives encouragement in the midst of attacks to others. Verse 14, wait on the Lord. Be patient. Wait on the Lord, be of good courage, and he shall strengthen your heart. Oftentimes we find that with trials, it's not about making the trial go away, but just trying to be strong enough to get through the trial. I can remember, and I know most of you have, you know, had the same experience where it's like, okay, I guess I have to go through this. Can you help me to be strong enough to get through this? Wait, I say, on the Lord. So David was advocating for patience while he was in the midst of being attacked when the immediate outcome was unknown. And it seems to echo a statement made by Jesus Christ later as well, where he said, those who endure to the end will be saved. Going back to patience. So patience is showing love toward God. That's what we're looking at, right? The commandment is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and might. When we display patience, when we demonstrate patience for the plan of God, regardless of the fact that at times we do suffer, Paul teaches us that it is an act of love toward God. Let's move on. 1 Corinthians 13:4. The next one in verse 4 is love is kind. I said we'd do a deep dive on three of these and then gloss over. We're going to do a deep dive on this one as well. Are we kind to God? That made me stop. I thought that was an interesting question. How is a person kind to God? Let me share a story about kindness. True story. I had a coworker once that I considered a very kind man. He called me once after a meeting to apologize in case I was offended by something he said. I didn't hesitate for a moment in responding to what he said. I said, Dean, his name was Dean. I said, Dean, I think so highly of you and your kindness that you always show that you would have to try very hard to offend me. Even if I began to feel off about something you said, I would just assume that I had misunderstood you. So if you ever mean to offend me, you better pack a lunch, because it's going to take some work. True story. Of course, we both laughed it off, and then we moved on. But it made me think. I remembered that experience when I got to love is kind and showing kindness to God. Shouldn't I have a similar attitude toward God and his instruction? Dean's history of kindness toward others allowed me to be kind and generous in return. What does kindness toward God look like? Let's look at this as one example. You'll be able to think of many more. Matthew 11 has an appropriate story for us. It involves John the Baptist, who was becoming concerned about what he was seeing. He had expectations, and they weren't being met. Matthew 11, verse 2. And when John had heard in prison about the works of Christ, he sent two of his disciples and said to him, Jesus Christ, said to him, are you the coming one, or do we look for another? Now remember, John knew Jesus. They were cousins. May not have always seen each other, but they were cousins. John had baptized Jesus and declared Jesus to be the Lamb of God. He knew who this person was. But he was confused because he had expectations of what the Messiah would be doing, and he didn't see all of it being performed. Verse 4. Jesus answered and said to them, didn't answer the question directly, but he answered, go and tell John the things which you hear and see. And then he quotes a number of things which are in the prophecies about the Messiah. He says, the blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear. The dead are raised up, and the poor have the gospel preached to them. And blessed is he who is not offended because of me. He was concerned that John might become offended because John had an expectation that wasn't being met. And so Jesus was reminding him, yes, there's all of these prophecies. You see some of them being fulfilled. This may not be something that you understand, but this is what's happening. And yes, he doesn't quite say it, but yes, I am the one you're expecting. We won't cover it, but you'll recall there was also a time when thousands of people were following Jesus, primarily right at the beginning of his ministry. And they came to him partly because he was feeding them, partly because he was teaching them in a way that was completely different than what they had heard before. And then they became offended because he started telling them how they needed to change. He started meddling, I guess is the way that one of our pastors used to call it. Now you're meddling. Well, there are times when we are challenged by what God teaches us and expects of us. And just as the Bible records people walking away from Christ because they were offended by the instruction, we have seen people in our modern era walk away from God because they were offended by something. Maintaining a disposition of kindness toward God, which assumes the best interests even when they're not understood, it's a defense against falling away. Showing kindness toward God is loving God. I'm sure you can explore this subject of kindness even further than just my single example. We'll move quickly through the next several portions, but I did want to mention them. Because you can think about your own questions to ask yourself, am I loving God in this way? Paul says love does not envy. We know that Satan envies God. Obviously, we don't want to reflect that type of attitude. Envy suggests a selfish desire for gain or perhaps even loss to another. As long as neither one of us gets it, I'm okay with that. You know, I've seen that attitude with people out there. Paul says love does not boast and that it's not proud. How could one who's actually called by God boast and ever say that they deserve what God is offering them? It can't be done. Grace is unmerited. In verse 5, Paul makes a statement that love does not behave rudely. And that contrasts with the instruction that love is kind. In some translations, behaving rudely says dishonor others. Now that's interesting, because in another place, Paul talks about dishonoring God. It's in Romans chapter 2. No need to turn there. I'm just going to refer to it. But he says, "You who make your boast in the law, do you dishonor God through breaking the law?" So Paul's pointing out that there is a behavior of boasting. There's a behavior of rudeness when one does break God's law. Now, Paul had personal experience with this. Consider a man named Saul, a man with a lot to be proud of and a lot to be boastful about on a mission, a special mission from the high priest out of Jerusalem. I think he probably had a ribbon across his chest. It's me. I'm here. You recall that on that mission that Paul was blinded. This feels reminiscent of Revelation 3, talking about Laodicea. In Revelation 3, Jesus Christ talking to the church says, "Because you say, 'I am rich, have become wealthy, and have need of nothing,' and do not know that you are wretched, miserable, poor, blind, and naked." Paul had that experience physically, firsthand. And in another place, he calls himself, "Oh, wretched man that I am." Paul was no Laodicean. Contrast this with the instruction from Jesus Christ in the Beatitudes. Matthew 5:3 says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." Again, the contrast to boasting is poor in spirit. The contrast is recognizing wretchedness, miserableness, poor, being blind and naked. The good news is that we can be fed, we can be clothed, our sight can be opened, spiritually speaking, obviously. Continuing in 1 Corinthians 13, "Love is not self-seeking, it's not easily angered, it keeps no record of wrongs." I don't believe that anybody here would be doing any of these things, but there are plenty of people in the world that keep a record of how they feel God wronged them. I like to look at a Reddit and online. And I like to get into the Christianity subreddit and look at what people are saying. And it's incredible some of the conversations that people have where they do blame God for things that happen in their life. If anything goes right in their life, it's because they did it. If anything went wrong, it's because God did it. It's crazy. Verse 7. Love always protects, it always trusts, it always hopes, it always perseveres. And isn't that the model of our loving relationship toward God? We should always be protecting that relationship. Prayer, Bible study, fasting. And when I say this, I'm talking to myself too. Always trust in God. It takes time to develop trust in God. It takes time to understand that God will get us through as long as we stay on his path, committed to it, that he will get us through to the goal he has for us. And then finally, through the lens of how all this applies to our love for God, Paul says this, love never fails. Now we will falter. We will. And we will make mistakes. But as long as we're repentant and turning back toward God, becoming more like him, we will not fail. The only way we could actually fail is by walking away and no longer allowing God to work in us to develop his character. One thing I always try to remind people is God didn't put us on this path knowing we would fail. He put us on this path because he was confident that if we will follow him, stay committed to him, and be changed by him, that he will succeed with us individually. It's not even our success, it's his success. The greatest commandment is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and strength. I said this verse in Deuteronomy is arguably one of the greatest keys in properly worshiping God. If we love God the way that Paul talks about love, our relationship with God is incredibly strong. It will stand up under trials. It will stand up under testing. Paul provided a criteria here in 1 Corinthians 13 by which we may take a detailed look and a self-evaluation of our love for God. And I challenge you all to use Paul's list to evaluate how you are meeting the instruction to love the Lord your God.